So thank you very much for your kind words, Michael. I'm tempted to paraphrase the Reverend Michael Curry, who said a lady got promoted and all of you turned up. So a professorial lecture is both daunting and thrilling at the same time, and that's exactly how I feel. It has been a long journey here, and I will not pretend that it was easy. Being on this podium today moves me to do three things. Start with a reflection of how I got here. Contemplate on my role as a privileged member of the UK Academy, as my son, Edwin Grove, often tells me to do. Credit those that inspired me and who continue to enable me in my professional capacity then and now. This is a difficult moment for academics both here and globally, in countries as far afield as Turkey and India, with ever-increasing challenges in terms of job security and crackdowns on academic freedom. My own home university, JNU, New Delhi, has seen a wave of arrests in the wake of student and faculty protests. And I'm very pleased that two of my contemporaries and teachers from that time are here in the audience today, Mrudula Mukherjee and Aditya Mukherjee. Closer to home, as the recent strikes demonstrate, we are also facing our own problems. As a migrant female academic crisscrossing two cultures, I've had to encounter my own set of challenges. But this is still a better time to be a woman academic, as the increasing number of my female colleagues can testify, particularly in pushing the glass ceiling, both in the UK Academy and, of course, in history. But it has not always been so. As a biographer of E.K. Janaki Ammal, the Indian woman botanist, a relative of my mother, whose papers I'm currently editing, I'm struck by her experiences, despite being a formidable scholar, an ethnobotanist, who rose to be the first female employee of the Royal Horticultural Society in England, and the director of the Botanical Survey in India, of the gender, race, and caste discrimination she faced in her scientific career over a sustained period from the 1930s until the 1970s, both in Britain and in India. Her subdued resistance in the face of professional challenges has been an inspiration for my own career. I was also fortunate earlier on as a student in England in meeting Richard Grove, pioneering environmental historian and environmental activist, whose profound insights into the discipline of a global environmental history and its links with environmental activism enabled me to pursue new academic paths in the field of South Asian environmental history. For an urban denizen from Delhi, our long rain-drenched walks amidst the coppice trees of Hayley Wood in Cambridgeshire was a revelation, not least for the fact that my chappals, Indian flip-flops, were totally unsuitable for the inclement English weather. As a historian of Indian nationalism, I had explored the nature of peasant nationalism and resistance and the challenges it posed to the colonial and newly decolonized Indian state in Bihar in the 1930s and 40s under the supervision of the renowned historian Bipin Chandra. But most of all, it was my work on Indian Adivasis or tribal communities and their fight for the forest that fueled my interest in the nature of resistance. In this body of work, I have explored the impact of globalization, modernization, and deforestation in the longer durée on these communities. Part of what I will be presenting today represents this work in the context of the environmental history of India. What is environmental history? The origins of environmental history as a self-conscious domain of inquiry can be traced to the encounter of 17th and 18th century Western Europeans with the startlingly unfamiliar environments of the tropics and the damage inflicted on these environments in the course of extraction of European empires. The recognition of the role of the environment in modern historical inquiry was heralded when a new phase of global environmental history began with European decolonization from the 1950s onwards. And here, Jean Filios's work on South India regional study was born out of his interest in ethnobotany and marks the first steps of a South Asian environmental history. The Nile School had, of course, in the 1950s elaborated the role of geography and climate in the material sense in European history over long time frames. In the 1980s, environmental historians such as Donald Worster argued that the cultural history of nature was as important as the ecological history of culture. For Worster, the purpose of environmental history was to put nature back into historical studies, or define more elaborately, to explore the ways in which the biophysical world has influenced the course of human history, and the ways in which people have thought about their natural surroundings. In his narrative, capitalism emerges as the pioneering and still the most important architect of the new integrated modern world economy since the 1500, with a maximizing culture in terms of resource use. The history of British colonialism in India, in terms of its relationship to the natural world, can be seen to be part of this global narrative of capitalism. This global understanding figured in the work of two pioneering historians of India, John F. Richards and Richard Tucker, whose foray into South Asian environmental history emerged from their research in agrarian history, leading them to a realization that a global framework of reference was essential to understand the South Asian environment. This was further developed in Richard Grove's magnum opus on the environmental history of empire, Green Imperialism, which was a study of the British Empire and the natural world from oceanic islands to continental land masses. There was less emphasis on regional and local histories of South Asia, which we sought to address in our volume, Nature and the Orient, on the environmental history of South and Southeast Asia. This was a book that Richard and I edited in the 90s. Following which, a series of regional histories emerged with Mahesh Rangarajan, Rohan D'Souza, Vasant Sabarwal, and K. Shivaramakrishnan, whose work described the colonial watershed moment in the forest and water history of Central India and Orissa, and examined colonial constructions of nature and the creation of boundaries of forest, wasteland, and the partitioning of landscapes and the defining of communities. There were, however, still large gaps in the literature of environmental history, particularly at the level of the locality. This required drawing not only on colonial archives, but on oral histories of the landscape, including folklore, proverbs, and songs. One cannot overemphasize the importance of understanding local, historical, and ecological settings for any study on communities, rights, governance, and identity, and the local impacts of global processes. Neither can one, quoting Anna Singh, ignore the need to study human histories within a multi-species field of histories. In other words, the relationships of humans to plants, animals, insects, and even microbes. This is the sense in which place and locality are being reconfigured, where histories of particular communities and their experience of ecological pressures and change over time can be part of a broader social agenda aimed at local empowerment and environmental awareness from which emancipatory imaginings may emerge. As my co-author Alex Asher notes in a special issue we edited together in honor of Brian Morris, eminent anthropologist, in anthropology as well, a new multi-species ethnography is emerging as a necessary way of writing culture in the Anthropocene, attending to the remaking of the Anthropos as well as its companion and stranger species on planet Earth. Recent research argues that human ecological relations need to be assessed as a kind of knowledge for life, quote unquote. It is here that the stories of communities that I'm going to be talking about today, whose worlds embrace what the climate historian Michael Hume has called other ways of living and being on this planet, become important. The concept of the Anthropocene, the idea that humans have become geological agents capable of moving the Earth from the stable Holocene period of the last 10,000 years into a new geological era through their activities, itself has come in for sustained critique. Some environmental historians, such as Jason Moore, prefer the term Capitalocene as it poses the tough questions elided by the Anthropocene, questions of power, difference, political economy, and history. Having set the context of place-based history and knowledge in environmental history and the elision of local histories in Anthropocene narratives,
We will now move our focus to the forest and environmental history of eastern India through the stories of its communities and their lived relationship with the natural world. It can be argued that the greatest physical impact of globalization today on people and landscape in South Asia is being exerted in the mountainous parts of Orissa, Chhattisgarh and Jharkhand, coincidentally among the poorest states in India and subject to long histories of deforestation and more recently large-scale mining. Since 1991, as the last pretense of tribal protection has been given up, eastern India has become subject to new kinds of internal and external colonization, far more traumatic in its impact than the pre-1947 colonization. The long history of tribal resistance from Birsa Munda in 1897 to Kalinganagar in 2006 to what can only be seen as enclosures by both the colonial and the post-colonial state stands out as a marker of renewed resilience in the face of unrestrained globalization and climate change in the context of the Anthropocene. In other words, there is much we can learn from these communities in terms of resilience thinking for the Anthropocene. For current day developmental specialists working on resilience thinking, I would argue that resilience can be recuperated through resistance. As historians, we can bring the politics back to Anthropocene and resilience thinking by focusing on agency and power in resilience science. Through studying locality and place in a long time frame, we can offer examples of good resilience versus bad resilience, which range from resilience in the aftermath of the New Orleans disaster to fishing communities in the Philippines, to Mexico, to Bolivia and eastern India, where it has been documented that communities less engaged with the market were more resilient to climate vulnerability. Traveling to the forests of Saranda from Ranchi last year with Gladson Dumdum, tribal rights activist and scholar, and Rohan D'Souza, environmental historian, I was saddened when a CRPF officer blocked our entrance into the reserve due to continuing anti-Maoist vigilance. I had visited the reserve with Richard in 2005, the magnificent reserve Sal Forest of Saranda, whose proportions were set in the colonial period, were rapidly eroding under pressure of development following the cleansing of Maoists in the region. This was a forest which is extremely important in biodiversity and cultural terms, both for local communities and the Indian imaginary. Not only is it part of the lost ecological and cultural world of Adivasi communities, but it fueled the imagination of Bengali intellectuals such as Bibhuti Bhushan Bandyopadhyay, who wrote Aranyak round it. In 2005, when I first visited it, Saranda Forest was part of a core elephant reserve and was in a bid for World Heritage status by the Ministry of Forests. The World Wildlife Fund was also very interested in its status. It later became a Maoist stronghold in the long fight between disaffected left intellectuals, local communities and the state over right to resources in the context of the growing poverty and inequality in the region. Following the purging of Maoists, the Saranda Development Plan sought to hasten the carving up of the reserve into mining leases. The story of Saranda is part of the story of eastern India's rapid transformation in the colonial and post-colonial period and the resistance to it by both local indigenous communities and political groupings such as the Maoists. The history of tribal communities was also an environmental history, both green and brown, of its eastern India, of a sacred landscape gradually despoiled since 1800, reserved and protected by British colonial policy, marked by resistance and state violence, most notably in the 1830s, 1890s, and most recently in 2006 and after, resulting, as I said, in the killing of 12 tribals following their protests against mining by Tata. Mapping the story was the environmental history of globalization. What I've done here is mapped it in these three phases, 1800 to 1947, 1947 to 1991, and 1991 to date, following the relentless pursuit of privatization by a new liberal state determined to carve up the forest into mining leases. So today I will primarily concentrate on the first phase and will document the early history of globalization and colonial intervention and its impact on the land and forests especially in the Chotanagpur Plateau, now Jharkhand. So the number, I've given you here some data about the region, the area, the number of communities that populated it according to the census in 1911. So from 1872 to 1911, the population seems to have increased from 3 million to about 6 million. By the 1930s, the term Adivasi had become prominent as a form of self-identification, or the original inhabitant. Then increasing differentiation among Adivasis today is well recognized in scholarship. And the term itself has been debated extensively, especially if it embraces the idea of indigeneity. However, as I've noted elsewhere, the term must be seen as a political one, an Adivasi struggle in the 20th century, as part of a struggle for recognition and rights. It's indisputable that many of these communities have over time experienced the biggest land grabs in history. Currently, Jharkhand has officially over 7 million tribal communities out of a state population of 26 million. India still has 8% of its population categorized as tribal in the latest census, i.e. in the region of about 100 million. When the British arrive in the region in 1765, they relentlessly pursue the idea of the frontier through the Southwest Frontier Agency, bringing recalcitrant tribes to heel, forcing allegiance by local chiefs, imposing taxation, crushing rebellions. And you get an indiscriminate killing of wildlife. And there's actually, by the 1830s and 1840s, they're offering huge prices for the killing of wildlife. The railways followed in the 1850s, facilitating the process of change and the destruction of traditional patterns of life. The railways entered Chotanagpur in three sides, and the course of entering, a huge number of forests were destroyed. In many ways, this story was to be very, very damaging for the community, because as we know, the original forest, and if you look at the archival record, and here I'm going to speak primarily to my PowerPoint, the original forests were spread out over thousands of square miles, especially in the districts of Hazaribagh, Singbung, Palamu, and Ranchi. It's important to note that indigenous rulers had tended to preserve the forest for military reasons. In several parts of Chotanagpur, the forests have been kept forested with great care by the Rajas as a protection against invasion from without. The trees were mainly either moist deciduous or dry deciduous, and the whole division had a very rich growth of Shorya robusta trees or sal trees. And this is the largest surviving sal forest in Asia, the Saranda forest, which I'm talking about. The best sal trees were found here in the valleys where in good soil, straight trees, 100 to 120 feet in height with a girth of 10 to 15 feet were found. Other important trees, including the mahua, the asan, the pal, the karam, the tun, the paisal, the shisham, the kusum, the bear, and the ficus trees of different types. What I've argued, and what the colonial sort of record shows, that the Adivasi dependence on forests, and especially on wild food resources, was considerable. Valentine Ball noted in the 1860s that many of the tribes were heavily dependent on jungle products. The carriers of the Jolari Hills, who were not settled agriculturists, relied on the jungle for the supply of fruits, leaves, and roots. This they supplemented with rice procured from the lowland agricultural communities by trading jungle products such as lac, sal seeds and leaves, and tussar cocoons. Most of the communities had a complex knowledge of the jungle. The Hos of Singbung, for example, were essentially a forest group, had names for all the common plants and those of economic importance to them, like the forest mundas, were well versed in the edible properties of plants. The Brumage in the extreme east of Singbung were a wandering community who lived by snaring monkeys and by collecting the fiber of the Bohonia Valia creeper. The forest environment and a deep knowledge of it was of critical importance to the local communities, particularly in diet terms. The importance in food terms was paralleled by its significance in systems of belief, and in fact, not truly separable in those terms. The most important belief system, of course, that we are talking about today are this whole idea of the sacred grove. In Chotanagpur, a symbiotic relationship had prevailed between the people and their forest for the period that, of the 19th century that that has been recorded by these amazing British travelers and administrators. The local cultural and aesthetic values that were encompassed within hunting, fishing, and gathering activities found expression in elaborate rituals and ceremonies that celebrated the natural world. For example, the Mundas regarded the sun with awe and reverence and called it Singh Bonga. Here, individual trees represented a woman, and initiation ceremonies included young boys making love to trees. The worship of a rain god was also common among them and other tribes in Chotanagpur. Most important, however, was the ritual significance of the grove. A sal grove was uniformly dedicated in every village to the forest gods whose favor was bought by sacrifice. The consecrated grove was religiously preserved, the young trees being occasionally pruned, though not a twig could be cut for use without the formal consent of the village. It was also necessary to propitiate the spirits residing in the jungles who had been disturbed by the pioneer families who had first cleared the jungles, and it was the duty of the village to make periodical sacrifices to these spirits who haunted the forests and the wastelands. Thus the rituals sought to assuage the spirits disturbed by human intervention. Every Munda village, for example, had its own particular spirit whose duty it was to look after the crops. Such spirits were known as Dasawali and played a large part in Munda festivals, which were connected with the cultivation of the land. The home of this presiding deity was the Sarna, or sacred grove, a little path of jungle that, when all else was cleared for cultivation, was left as a refuge for gods where they might dwell apart. At all seasons of the year, offerings were made to the Sarna, for on the favor of Dasawali depended the success or failure of their crops. So the sacred grove kind of plays a very important role in the local festivals of the people. To move on to the next point of colonial forest policy, by the 1860s, the British were formalizing one of the biggest land takeovers in history. The motivations of this were mixed and included aesthetic, revenue, and climatic considerations. Here is Stebbing, who was one of the great foresters, writing about the jungle byways of India. So the romanticization of the jungle, the aesthetic value of the jungle. At the same time, as Richard has amazingly shown, green imperialism, these variety of reasons for them trying to take over the forest. And they had adequate reason to do so, because following the relentless destruction of forest between 1765 and the 1830s, as I've argued, including the indiscriminate killing of wildlife, it was clear that a forest department needed to be constituted. And there are lots of stories about how Lord Dalhousie, Joseph Hooker met Lord Dalhousie, and we've got the great biographer of Hooker in the audience, Jim Endersby. And there was that sort of inspired the creation of the 1865 Forest Act. But the 1865 Forest Act was extremely inadequate. In certain areas, it was argued that the progress of the department was slow. And at the Forest Conference in 1873-74, the defects of the 1865 Act were brought to notice. One of the main deficiencies which was noticed by Hope in 1878 was that it drew no distinction between the forest that required to be closely reserved, even at the cost of more or less interference with private rights, and this is the rights of communities, and those that merely needed general control to prevent improvident working. So the whole issue of rights is becoming very, very important to them as they are thinking of conserving large areas of the landscape, or in fact sterilizing it for future purposes. And we can debate whether it was an enclosure or whether it was custodianship. So the 1878 Act was passed, extending policies regarding reserve forests and protected forests. So there are three categories of forests: reserved, protected, and village. Every possible safeguard against infringements by private rights surrounded the first-class constitution of reserve forests, which were secured by permanent settlement. The second-class demarcation was of protected forests, which offered less sufficient guarantees for stability and protection and allowed for rights. So common rights of these communities could accrue in these forests. There also were large private forests that they leased from political states, independent, autonomous Indian states. By 1898, 33,738 square miles of forest were closed to all animals. This is an all-India figure. And 28,146 square miles were closed to browsers, making it possibly one of the largest enclosures in history. By 1899, 20,000 square miles of government forests were covered by working plans, of which 1,900 square miles were in Bengal. And so this whole idea of working plants is the whole discourse of scientific forestry. Jim Scott has written about it, making the landscape legible. Shiva Ramakrishna has extensively written on it. And the way in which these working plants worked was to categorize the forest as productive for revenue purposes and to completely close it off from private interests. In Saranda, you get about 306 square miles of Saranda being constituted as one reserved range. And this was with devastating implications for local communities. It was managed by one forest ranger, and it was three forest guards, and it was closed to local communities. Today, the area of Saranda is 800 square miles, if Felix can correct me on this. And when you're looking at the archives, the debates are incredible. You can see the arguments, as I said, aesthetic, the whole idea of custodianship also came about. The government, as guardian of all public interests, insists on the regulation of rights so as to render possible the good management of the reserve forest in the interest of the country, says the Indian Forester. So this idea of imperial custodianship is quite important. The issue of common rights continues to preoccupy local officers such as McPherson and Phillips. The latter noted in 1920, while drawing up the working plans for Saranda, the topographical maps of 60 years ago show quite a number of villages or old village sites whose names and sites have in most cases been forgotten. So the Saranda enclosure was particularly devastating because it was a reserve forest in the elite sense. No rights accrued in Saranda. So a huge number of villages were dispossessed. In the areas such as the protected forest, which we talked about earlier, you had large-scale protests. In Saranda, there was just dispossession. The biggest, as I said, the land grab in history seems to have occurred in this period in the 19th century. So it was an exclusionary forest system that emerges from the 1878 Forest Act, an exclusionary forest system which reserved between one-fifth and one-sixth of India's lands, shut out hunters and farmers from their traditional resources, and has caused chronic social conflict since its foundation. There's one argument, and some historians have advanced it, and some that without it, no significant forest cover would have survived in South Asia, which, like most of the tropics, was subject in the 19th century to an entirely new kind of globalizing economic penetration in which traditional common property arrangements could not have survived. In China and Thailand, where no significant reserve systems developed, the forests have now largely disappeared. By contrast, in India, the forest area was stabilized for nearly a century from about 1870. So the whole, what I want to look at briefly is the way in which, as a historian, I approached the archives. And here are some of the forest files of Chaibasa, which is this the Forest Record Office. And what was interesting to me as a historian working through these files was the village record office was not for people like me. I was put on the veranda to drink a cup of tea, while the people entering the village record office were lawyers with their clients. So indigenous claim making and indigenous claim making to land and territory was built into, and the only way in which the only thing they could rely on was these forest records, was these land settlement records. So the entire village record office and the archives in Ranchi were taken up by lawyers and their clients. So for visiting researchers, your only position was in the veranda drinking tea and looking at these streams of lawyers and their clients going in. And here's the meticulous record of colonial officers, of the area that they are putting into protected forests, the village. So it's an invaluable archive. Many of them, and this is where I'm putting my hat on as a conservationist of archives, and this is where one of my networks, which I link up with the British Library, is about conserving these archives and integrating these collections in order so that we have an understanding of how these forests functioned. So the next point I just briefly want to say is this totalizing sort of discourse of scientific forestry, the taking over of these large areas of land, was not without resistance. Birsa Munda's rebellion against forest regulations in 1890 is well known, but what is less known is that it was precisely, as Macpherson notes, if you look at the survey and settlement reports, that was in the context of the adjoining area of Porahat, adjoining Saranda, that Mundaris, who were evicted from their village, were the most rebellious. They had been evicted and they were active in this very, very well-known rebellion between 1896 and 1900. So the fact that it was forest rights that was instrumental in this rebellion needs to be written into these accounts. I move now to the impact of this on communities. How do we assess the impact of the above delineated colonial forest policy on tribal communities? I've argued that it was only in the mid-19th century that frontier regions such as Chotanagpur came well under the control of the East India Company and subject to the same pressures as mainland Bengal. This is particularly true if we assess the incidence of famine. Famine research has gained ground both in Asia and Africa, and it's well known that British India experienced a series of subsistence crises, particularly in the latter half of the 19th century. However, analysis of these famines by historians have rarely included a study of environmental changes. A knowledge of the ecological basis of different peasant economies is crucial to understanding the capacity of certain communities to withstand drought and other famine-related hazards. What I've argued is that modernization and commercialization were accompanied by pauperization and vulnerability to famine in large parts of India, but the process affected regions differently, as the evidence from Bengal shows. It was only in the latter half of the 19th century that the drastic effects of the processes which I've delineated, of taxation, modernization, and ecological transformation, caught up the outlying areas of Bengal and Bihar, resulting in a permanent destabilization of the tribal society in the region. That these processes had occurred in central Bengal over a century previously, the 1770 famine is of course very well known, where 10 million people died. The fact that the transition from pre-modern to modern was affected in India differentially, a regional focus reveals the uneven nature of development, local resistance to the forces of modernization, and the survival of husbandry techniques and coping strategies in times of scarcity that withstood the threats of modernization well into the 19th century. It was clear then that, as Rangarajan and Shivaramakrishnan note, that the landscape ordering and people sedentarizing policies of the East India Company were easier to conceive and more difficult to execute throughout the modern and colonial period. So what was important about this famine is that 1897 famine was the first to really affect the region. And the way in which colonial foresters dealt with it is important. Earlier on, there was a realization that the reserve forest and the closing off of access to food was intensifying the famine. And you get debates in the record about, do we open up the reserve forest? How long do you open it up for? Do you just open it up for 10 days? And invariably, in every case, they erred on the side of not opening up the forest for very long. So the effect of this was that by 1897, you had large numbers of people, and the data that we've got is quite dramatic. Large numbers of people affected by malnourishment, and who were increasingly in the throes of death. So this can be seen as the first famine. The 1897 famine can be seen as the first famine that killed. The jungle foods, which local communities had always depended on, had been severely depleted. Women had to travel much further to collect such foods, and they had little that they could procure now that was that enabled them to be sustained. Once they could have lived comfortably on a diet of mahua flowers and roasted sal seeds, supplemented with small fish and water chestnuts. Many of the mahua trees were now in private hands or in reserve forests. The central and eastern plateau, where once the best sal forests had been found, were denuded, and only small scrub jungle remained. Enfeebled by a low diet of limited jungle produce, the people fell prey to various diseases, mainly cholera. It proved to be a devastating killer. In August and September 1897, the mortality was 21.18 per milli. The cholera epidemic was also quite instrumental in this, for this. So how do local people respond? They respond through distress migration. So by the latter half of the 19th century, you see huge numbers of who are distressed who are moving to Assam and who are moving, as we know, to the tea gardens in Assam. The large plateau was a monotonous expanse of dried up fields, recorded the colonial officer, with scarcely any vegetation. The once jungle-covered scarps had been reduced to scrub, and the tops of the flat-top mountains, which were once the hunting grounds for the Nilgai deer, were devoid of all game. In practice, migration by the poorest and most vulnerable rural strata was one of the commonest survival strategies adopted in times of drought and famine. So you see the narrative of drought and famine in the songs, in the proverbs, and in the of the period, which I don't have time to go in here. So I move now to the last phase of my presentation, which is the recurring phase of famine and what I've outlined. What I've outlined for the 19th and early part of the 20th century is the destruction of traditional tenures and forests of local communities in Chota Nagpur. And in the face of vehement tribal resistance, this seems to have continued to occur. The whole-scale destruction of rights and the reduction of access to forest resources, to which they had been long dependent for sustenance, not just in times of scarcity and crisis, critically destabilized the economy and pushed them into a cycle of famine, which had long plagued the people of the plains. It was in this sense that processes of globalization and colonial intervention transformed the region, bringing poverty and emissarization to a majority of the tribal groups. What happened since 1947? Since 1945, of course, you continue to get 5 million people, mostly Adivasis, being forcibly removed or resettled, a forced migration rarely equaled globally in 20th century. In Orissa, you get the failure to redistribute land rights by the Orissa state. In the 1950s, which can be termed as a decade of environmental destruction, thousands of acres of Adivasi land lost to industries and cities. So the post-colonial period didn't bring out any change. And what is interesting is this immediate post-colonial period hasn't been studied by historians as much in terms of the environmental degradation. American hunters were being called and given because they were paying $1,000 to kill a tiger. So all through the 50s, that untold story of wildlife destruction needs to be told, which is very interesting, especially in the Nehruvian context. Post-91 and new enclosure, and I'll end with this. The period after 1991 has brought with it disturbing developments and a new enclosure movement, this time in the interests of private capital. The immediate period after independence, which saw the intensification of forest destruction in the interests of development, increased much more significantly in the period after 1991, when the last pretense of tribal protection has been given up by the Indian state, and when eastern India currently faces intensified resource extraction. Both Schedule 5 and Schedule 6 of the Constitution, which allowed some protection to these communities, are being watered down as we speak, as forest and tribal protection are being eroded. It's interesting that the British actually bring into place tribal protection at one point through their protection of common rights, which of course now is being completely sacrificed. It can be noted that there are no sacred frontiers today as far as mining is concerned. Across the country, mining is taking place inside and outside reserve forests, national parks, and wildlife sanctuaries. The historical causes and environmental consequences of these developments are only beginning to be researched, but need to be understood if local cultures and heritages are to be sustained alongside biodiversity protection. There is a renewed struggle in the region among tribal communities as the remaining common lands and forests are being transformed and being sold to private companies such as Vedanta and so on. Tatas is another culprit. Many of these companies are registered in the London Stock Exchange. Among others, we have amidst us today Felix Pardell, whose understanding of tribal cosmologies in the region is unsurpassed. Adivasi identities and beliefs are based on ancient linguistic, religious, and literary conceptualizations, and on cultural origin myths, as he argues, in which important deities are believed present in the distinctive mountain and deltaic landscapes, and especially, as I've pointed out, in sacred woodlands. Increasingly, Adivasi organizations in India today assert minority identities by promoting landscape and historical sites of significance in resistance histories as places of secular historical importance for state protection. Environmental activists such as Gladsang Dungdung, who belongs to the Kariya group, build on this landscape identity nexus and encourage activist resistance to forces threatening the moral economy of the landscape. They are also developing an alternative model of development and conservation appropriate to the poor majority of eastern India, brought in place of the failed science and extractive industry model, which has brought only intense changes and severe ecological degradation in this region. In the context of climate change, Mike Hume has argued the case for the humanities, noting that the positivist disciplines are ill-suited to engaging with and articulating the deeper human search for values, purpose, and meaning. Yet the search is exactly where humanity's new entanglement with global climate is taking us, to shed new light on multiple meanings of climate change in diverse cultures, and to create new entry points for policy innovation. The interpretative social sciences, arts, and humanities need new spaces for meeting as equals with the positivist sciences. Because the resource frontier impinges on Adivasis, an understanding of economic choices induced in globalizing resources is enmeshed in the issues of the Adivasis' future. As is well known, the concept of indigenous people is now upheld in international law, and this new indigenousness is internationalist and highly sympathetic to environmentalist agendas. The new indigenism claims group control over resources in regions as far as Bolivia, Ecuador, and Nigeria. For the mineral globalizers, it becomes essential to crush new notions of internationalized indigenousness. Conversely, the new indigenousness may potentially be a major bulwark against globalized environmental destruction, especially in South America and South Asia. As Lewis and Maslin note, in the global context of the massive environmental and climate change, the power that humans wield is like any other force of nature and can be used, withdrawn, or modified. The recognition that human actions are driving far-reaching changes to the life supporting infrastructure of the earth has philosophical, social, political, and economic implications. Invoking recognition has important political and philosophical connotations, and as Charles Taylor notes, looms large in contemporary politics, from nationalist movements to demands on behalf of minority and subaltern groups in feminism and multiculturalism. The invocation of recognition is the mainstay of political discourse. We need to embrace this politics of recognition. The recognition of the Adivasi and the recognition that our economic choices are enmeshed in the issue of the future of Adivasi communities is critical, as is the recognition that our human activities are driving far-reaching changes on the Earth's planet and have been for a very long time. Going back to my son's directive to assess my role in the academy, on reflection, it has been partly to facilitate such a politics of recognition. In this endeavor, I am truly grateful to my activist friends and associates of CWEH, Gladson Dungdung, Felix Pardell, Zuki Zerpa, whose belief that we can force change through active political engagement with institutions, companies, and local communities has been inspiring. There have been many others who have been with me on this journey. Pat Thane, who's here with us today, and Beryl Williams were early mentors to me at Sussex. As a brilliantly successful female academic, Pat's insights into the workings of the academy were invaluable Friendships and networks forged in these early years included Partha Mitter, who's here with us today, Alan Lester, who's also here with us today, Saul Dubow and Clive Webb, who's here with us today. Thank you for your support. Liz James, Claire Langhammer, and Lucy Robinson have always been my strong advocates, for which I thank them again. And I continue to learn from my younger female colleagues, who I now have the privilege to mentor. Sussex wouldn't be the same without my interactions in the corridor with the inimitable Ahmed and other members of the school office, including Deborah, the eagle-eyed administrator who often covers for me. Claire Rogers in Global Studies is another very important support and has been for many years. My South Asian sisters, Maya Unnithan, Laila Mehta, Priya Jishankar, Minoli Salgado, Sabita Menon, and Bhavna Sapath have helped maintain my cultural connections in the academy and out of it through our Diwali parties. My association with Richard's academic family has been equally important to this journey, especially his father, Dick Grove, who, as Britain's leading desert geomorphologist, continues to inspire me with his academic rigor. Most fruitful of all to my work have been the many interdisciplinary conversations under the auspices of the Center for World Environmental History with colleagues and members of many networks who include Mick Frogley and Dom Knifton in geography, Brian Morris, Maya Unnithan, and Alex Asher in anthropology, Laila Mehta in IDS, Rob Allen, who is here with us today from the Met Office, Mika Peck in the life sciences, Antonia Moon at the British Library, and many others too innumerable to name. Long may such conversations continue. My final thanks are to my family, my brother and my parents, especially my indomitable mother, who would have been very happy to have been here today had she been with us. Thank you very much.